to the Red, White, and Rude. I am your host, the conservative Latino, William Del Pilar, where I dive into the wildest flops, fiery dramas, and unexpected twists, shaking up entertainment, media, and beyond. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. And let's get down to it. It's a very heavy-filled show. First up, we are going to revisit the story that won't die. But there is new information, and that's Rachel Zegler's Snow White disaster. And then, while I'm a little late, but I have to give my thoughts on 538's polling collapse, because Nate Silver of 538 fame did start out and gain some of his more early fame to fantasy baseball, which is my industry, fantasy sports. And then we're going to move on to the White House Correspondent Association's ousting of a bigot for their correspondence dinner. The retread stories don't want to die. And again, there is new information, and that's Ubisoft's shadowy Tencent deal. And then before we close it out with a whirlwind of headlines like Elon Musk's ex-roller coaster, Harry Sisson's scandal, and Pat Sajak's game show encore, I will give you the unfiltered scoop on all of it. So, turn off the Bluetooth and tune into a conservative Latino's no-holds-barred look at what's crashing, cashing, and clashing in today's chaotic world. Before we get moving into all of that, though, do not forget to bookmark GrumliesMedia.com, where you can find this podcast and others. And don't forget to subscribe to us via your favorite platform, YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, E-Pandora, under the handle Grumblies Media. Excuse me. Excuse me. A little honey and Cajun spicy apple cider. Always good for the throat. I don't know. It just seems to work in my throat. So let's get into it. And apologies again. Ooh, had a little throat. So let's get into the flop that won't die, the fall of Rachel Zegler and Disney's Snow White remake. So for those of you who aren't aware of who Rachel Zegler is, and anybody who's been following the story knows who she is, but a little background here. She emerged as a Hollywood darling with a breakout role in West Side Story. That was about 2021. She got praise. There are high expectations for a potential big career for her. And from what I'm told, she can do it all. Sing, dance, and act. However, West Side Story was a complete bomb. You know, I think Steven Spielberg, who directed it, but this was one of his babies. Look, we were just tired of all the woke nonsense. You know, then you throw out West Side Story and part of the marketing's playing up the casting and Yo Soy Latino. I mean, it's just enough is enough. Even us Latinos are saying that's it. Come on, man, stop. But it was her casting of Snow White in Disney's live-action remake that was initially met with excitement. A new generation of kids will learn the tale of Snow White. And it positioned her as a fresh face for a new generation. However, by March of this year, after about a year of nonsense, her star power had dimmed. And I say dimmed, I do mean dimmed. Unlike by not only her outside of Hollywood, meaning social media, what we saw of her, but even on the set and within Disney Studios. You know, her career trajectory and Disney's latest project just completely cratering under her own controversy and the financial failure that comes with it. We're not sure she's going to be able to find another leading role job for who knows how long. We'll see, though. So what's all this controversy again? To quickly go over it, she criticized the 1937 Snow White classic, calling its prince a stalker, dismissed its traditional romance as outdated. And these women wonder why they can't find a man. You know, she promised a modernized remake, completely changing what the fairy tale is about, that focused on
women empowerment. And that clashed with the expectation of Disney's nostalgic fan base and the actual storyline. I mean, if you wanted to do a story like that, don't do Snow White. There was obvious outrage on social media and elsewhere. Why do I say elsewhere? Well, social media is not America. And no one in America went and saw this. Well, I don't want to say no one, but you do mind me. They accused her of disrespecting the beloved story and alienating the audience that Disney relies on, the family values audience. Now, there was also on-set tensions, professional criticism, and this is where some of the new stuff comes in. Edward Disney Miller, the son of producer Dan Miller, labeled Ziegler immature and unprofessional. He did that in a recent interview. Miller alleged Ziegler clashed with crew, ignored direction, and acted as if she knew better. Oye, esta muchacha ni sabe ni qué fue un día, está allí tratando de decir cómo vivió en nuestra vida. Again, she clashed with, what I said wasn't very nice. She clashed with crew, ignored direction, and acted as if she knew better. And it created a strained production environment. So, industry rumors did corroborate his claims. Anonymous crew members described Ziegler as difficult. Diva-like. And obviously we know what happened. Snow White, as I stated last week, opened to $43 million domestically against a budget ranging from anywhere from $240 to $370 million is what my research has said. Now, that $370 million, I would say, is probably not accurate. But then again, they completely did CGI after having live actors doing the dwarf, so we don't know. But regardless, $43 million domestically the week one. This second week, it's projected at $13.7 million domestically, 14. It earned about $4 million Friday. That's a massive big deal. And one of the sharpest drops for a Disney remake, signaling strong audience rejection. So these losses are going to exceed $150 million, probably higher. Once you factor in marketing. So this is a major financial tax bill, and it's going to be, as everybody predicted, a tax write-down for Disney. And it's been one miserable hit after another. I mean, they've had a couple hits here and there in between, but for the most part, 70%, 80% of all their woke crap has failed, and 20% has succeeded. Look, now everything's going to be a failure. You know, critics gave it mixed reviews. They praised the visuals, panned the script, and they said Ziegler's wooden performance failed to resonate, unless they were a pro-woke site. I read one interview we sat there and said that Ziegler shine and Gal Gadot fell on her face. That was the only place I said that. Then I noticed all the advertising on their site. I noticed how woke they are, how pro-Palestine they were, and you get the gist. Audiences scored it at 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, and they're saying is Ziegler's pre-release comments is a reason for their disdain. You know, I can't, Robert De Niro, one of my favorite actors, I can't stomach watching any of his work. I didn't watch The Irishman or whatever was happening. I just don't deal with it. My partner, Big John, said, well, you're missing out from good movies. No, I'm not. I watch plenty of movies from around the world now. Netflix and Amazon have opened that up to me, so I'm not missing squat. Yeah. So the film's woke reimagining champion by Ziegler was seen as a miscalculation, yeah, I think. And it contributed to a broader cultural backlash. Don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it or go woke, go broke. And that's what they did here. So here's a little bit more information that did come out. So after her 2024 Free Palestine Expos, excuse me, alongside the Snow White trailer, that gained a lot of backlash. And death threats against Gal Gadot. I haven't heard her not once come out and say, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean to put Gal Gadot in danger. She probably didn't care. Probably behind the scenes laughed and joked about it. That's my speculation. But one of the producers who'd invested a lot flew from L.A. to New York to confront her. Urge her, delete that. Protect this $240, which is probably another $100 million more investment that we're going to have to make to put the CGI dummies in there, a dwarf in there, you know. And she refused. Following her November 2024 Instagram rant, leaked Donald Trump and, quote, may Trump supporters never know peace, unquote. Platt made a second trip to New York, pressing her to tone down her rhetoric as it risked alienating half the audience. Now, let's be clear here. They're trying to salvage the movie. They're not trying to curtail her free speech. This is a private organization. They hired her, and Sean Penn tried to sue a studio back about 20 years ago because they gave him the job and took it away because of his political tones in public. And they're saying, you're going to hurt our film. And the courts ruled with the studio. You're going to see some of that stuff happening here. Well, you're not going to see it. What you're going to see is the Zanglers of the world not being hired because we conservatives, we had learned from the left, had a boycott. So Platt's persistence led Zegler to, she reluctantly agreed to a Disney-paid social media handler post-election. Yeah, alas, because Trump won. And it was clear the path the country was going back towards, the right path, the path of honor, dignity, of respect, not the path of hate, where she wishes hate on somebody, wishes death on somebody, wishes a lot of evil on somebody. And so, in other words, her bigoted comments weren't going to fly anymore. So that was a last-ditch effort to vet her post and salvage the film's image. Second intervention, mind you. And that was him as a veteran producer trying to safeguard his project and Disney's project. So, again, she was once a celebrated talent. She's now viewed as a liability. And this is an interesting insider stating this. Studios are reportedly wary of casting her in future projects. Y'all think that she's an outspoken, young, ignorant, and stupid woman. Ignorant being dumb, you just don't know. And stupid being, yeah, you do know. She's young and ignorant, but she's also stupid because she's been told, you're hurting our films and thus hurting your career. And let's be honest, she's well off. She's probably in the 1% of the country right now in earnings. She made $2 million on this movie, is my understanding. Gal Gadot made, I think, $15 million. So she's got a way to grow the climb still to those big fat paychecks because she hasn't led a hit yet. Meaning she hasn't had the starring role. Whereas Gal Gadot had Wonder Woman and a few others under her belt. But Zegler doesn't have that. Now she may not get that opportunity because of her own stupidity after she was told. Yeah. So again, she's an outspoken progressive. She trashed original Snow White. She's an anti-Trump, never Trumper with her rants. And she misjudged the waning woke era. And that was pushed by Obama and Biden, but rejected by Trump reviving America. So now she's turned herself from a celebrated talent to a liability. Then some people try to push back against the producer flying out there. Who are you to sit there curtail her freedom of speech? Well, Jonah Platt gave a scathing rebuke. Who is Jonah? He's the son of the producer, Mark Platt. You know, he called her out, said she's immature. Or I'm sorry, he called out her immature politics that forced his father to leave his family and fly cross country twice to manage her stupidity. That's my word, stupidity. He framed her as a reckless saboteur of a cherished Disney project. See, here's what she doesn't understand. This is going to limit how much the studio will spend on future movies and may even scrap movies and slow the process down, which means people aren't going to work. Thank you, Rachel. Yeah, selfish, bigoted, Colombian fool. Yo soy panameño. I'm Panamanian. We have ties to Colombia. We were part of Colombia. I deal with Colombians in a good and bad way every time I go to Panama. They're just another people like this. I think I should have taken the Colombian shot. Gets a little bit of a Panamanian in me coming out. But they're good people, Colombians. So, Platt, the son, accused her of hurting the film's box office because of personal politics. Her perceived arrogance, ignorance, stupidity, call it what you want. Platt says she was hijacking the conversation for her own immature desires, and she was. And futures and other stars are going to have to deal with this. I'm going to talk about it in the Rule Rundown, a very famous bigot, you know, whose wife left him, whose kid is, we don't know what it's become. And I look back, and I look at him and see his politics, and I'm like, yeah, you're messed up in the head.
I'll talk about that another day, star.
So what's the conclusion here? Well, the Snow White debacle and Zegler's fall from grace highlights the risk of alienating audiences and mishandling iconic properties. Disney, whoever said you can pass go with that script should be taken out behind the barn. Well, okay, I don't want to do that, say that. But should not be hired again. So, as far as I've seen, she has remained silent on all of this. You know, she's taking a beating. And her ego won't allow her to come out and apologize. Disney, now they face a reckoning. The film's failure raises big questions about the viability of its live-action remake strategy in this evolving cultural landscape. And there you have it. My update on Rachel Zegler. This is some good stuff. It was, didn't deal with the movie as much as the gossip behind the scenes. But it's interesting because it plays out with what my mental timeline of what may have happened that did happen. All right. I want to visit 538. Now, some of the you in the audience think, 538, what the hell is that? It's 14 game night? What is it? Well, 538, they were once trailblazers to data-driven political forecasting. But they did sports, they did Oscars, so they put out numbers and polls and things like that. They became a cultural type company in polling, you know, odds and things like that. And they soared to fame under Nate Silver's statistical wizardry. And we were all proud of him because Nate kind of got his name in fantasy baseball, and I come from the fantasy. Now Nate, he really blew up with his political polling there at Mother Jones, whereas my company blew up the fantasy sports world. So we each had our own success in different ways. So he was wizardry. I bought his book. I can't remember a sector of the nest. I got a third of the way, and I put it down. It was boring, dry, and I was hoping to learn something about how he did all this, and he wasn't willing to talk about that, so I found the book useless and didn't finish it, you know. But that said, 538 did crash and burn by this month, you know, or this month, as Disney pulled the plug amid layoffs and mounting criticism. And I'm going to get into all that. So it started out with glory days in 2008 to 2024. So, wow, you know, 16 years it looks like it had. I'm sorry, 14. Yeah, 16 years. But, again, glory days of 2008 to its 2024 polling misfires, which started much earlier. So the site's rapid fade reflects a mix of forecasting flops, shifting priorities in terms of Disney and ABC, and a media landscape that no longer forgave its stumbles. You have to remember, when you are woke, you're going to go broke. He was the darling because when they were winning, he accurately predicted that. But once he started shifting away from not predicting Democrats to win, people were angry because pollsters are supposed to go pro-left, as we saw with the Iowa polling right before the 2024 election, stating Kamala was many points ahead, and she lost by like 7 or 8 points. You know, and that's how polling works. You know, currently right now with Trump, that's how it's working. You get these aggregator sites, including some very outlier type poll numbers from the formerly legitimate sites that have gone leftist, and that kind of skews it to show Trump's numbers worse than they are. But then they can just reference the polls or the aggregation of polls and say he's dropping. I'm a self-taught poster, so I know this. Self-taught because I didn't have the money to pay the tens of thousands, so I actually learned it myself. Bought 3 or 4 books, read through them all, figured out how to write polling, how to break them down, then how to word the questions. It's a whole process. Some say it's very scientific process. It's just a common sense process. Anyway, back to 538. Disney shut down 538 on March 5th, 2025. Like I said, I'm a little late on it, but I didn't really realize it until this past week. Because I used to follow them, and I stopped following them. You know, and this was all part of layoffs at ABC News, which is obviously a Disney subsidiary. So the entire 538 staff, 15 employees, were laid off, ending a 7-year run under ABC News. So Disney layoffs, they've cut 200 positions so far, about 6% of its workforce across ABC News and Disney Entertainment Networks. And what happens is they're letting go of the fluff. They're letting go of what they feel they don't need or they can do without. because they are going to continue providing polling. What's going to happen? They're going to have a few people on their staff monitoring and who are familiar with it, and they're going to work with actual data analysis platforms across its network to give you, hey, ABC News and Ipsos brings you, ABC News and Marist, you know, ABC News and whatever, you know. So, the shutdown sparked outrage among journalists, you know, saying, blah, whatever. You know, we just lost a key data journalism platform. No, you did not. So, the 538 website was disconnected immediately after the announcement, you know, and it was brutal. You know, Nate Silver left a year or so ago over disagreements. In essence, it doesn't matter why he left. He was part of the negativity that began to surround it because he was calling the shots. I think he was smart. He saw the writing on the wall and goes, I'm out of here. That happened to me when I sold my company. You know, none of the promises were being kept. I was fighting for the troops, fighting to keep the company growing. They didn't care. They just wanted it. This was an era where .com or selling like gangbusters. They just wanted to hurry up and sell it. And eventually, hey, I'm a political junkie and economic junkie. And I saw the winds of change coming. I tried to warn them. They failed to listen. I left in the class. And that's kind of what happened here to 538. Disney, they're looking to streamline their operations and, again, cut costs is how they're looking at it. And, again, you cut costs by getting rid of underperforming sectors. In fact, ABC News president Amin Karamanmadovich, he informed the 538 staff of their firing via a virtual meeting. He read from a script and took no questions. That is brutal. That is no compassion. I don't want to be here. I want to do the dirty deed and I'm out of here. What's the best way to do that, gentlemen? Do it via Zoom, boss. Read it. Here's your script. Read it. Don't take questions. Say goodbye. Click. Boop. They're out. That's what happened. So 538, for those who aren't aware, they were licensed by the New York Times after his 2008 sensational prediction. And that came true because of the great banking failure. You know, the end was near for Republicans at that point. The devil would have been elected if he'd been a Democrat nominee. So it wasn't hard to predict, but he was pretty spot on. You know, so once the 2008 election, that he was royalty. New York Times licensed and boosting their prominence because whether you like it or not, New York Times, that gives you credit. Then ESPN acquired them in 2013, 3 years later. And they integrated them into the sports and analytics portfolio. They transferred the they transferred from ESPN to ABC News in 2018, 5 years later, after ESPN's ownership. You know, Disney owned them. ESPN probably wasn't seeing the traction with them. And ABC News eventually took it over. So, Silver left ABC News in 2023, Nate Silver. And he took his forecast model with Silver Bulletin as SipSat. And he'll get a few people there, but he won't see the mass traffic he saw before. And once he left, they developed a new statistical model. And they did develop sports verticals, NFL, NBA, and MLB, until Disney axed that in 2023. So when Nate left, they axed all the sports sites. And it was ABC News. They said, we're only going to focus on news. And the writing was on the wall. Okay, you're in 2023. You want statistical analysis. What, because of what? What's coming up in 2024 election cycle? Now, you hear me keep talking about Nate's great 2008 prediction. So in 2008, 538, or rather Nate Silver, accurately predicted the presidential election outcome in 49 out of 50 states, missing only Indiana. I got to be honest, as a fantasy guy, as a stats cruncher, as being one of the top fantasy football players in the country, as having one of the top sites in accuracy, we knew what we were talking about. So when I saw that, I'm like, you go, bro, because it was good. But in that political term, our cycle was not that hard. I remember when I was asked, I said, look, McCain has a good chance of winning despite all the odds. because of the culture of America, barring nothing catastrophic happened. Something catastrophic happened. The banking collapsed. And when that happened, I was asked again. I said, yeah, McCain's done. And not only that, McCain is not reacting to this well. He's, we are now in the sea of change, culturally and economically. So when I saw that, I'm like, well, he put in the work. Congrats to him. Yeah, in the 2010 midterms, his forecasts, again, were close to the actual outcomes. His House prediction underestimated the Republican wave. In 2012, that was a midterm. 2012 was an easy one, too. He correctly predicted the presidential election outcome in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. But there was voter fraud in there, and here's why I know. There was not one precinct in Philadelphia voted for Mitt Romney in certain areas, which is a statistical impossibility. But where were the Republicans? Nowhere. And as I eventually learned, once the vote is in the system, my friends, you can't pull it out, and you can't figure out where the fraud is coming from. Much less you're going to say there is no fraud, and since you can't prove what's a legit ballot and what isn't, kind of screwed. Democrats have perfected this to an art. It's why they want mail-in ballots. That's why they want illegals to get free driver's license, because a lot of states are moving towards DMVs auto-registering you to vote. And they busted California. Oh, I'm sorry. Did we do that? It was an accident. We'll fix it, which they never did. In 2014, specific gubernatorial accuracy, not the governors, but they did pretty good again. You know, they weren't perfect, but they did pretty good. Some of the seats that they should have gotten, they did not get. But overall, 2014 midterms were okay. It started to unravel in 2016 because they were predicting early on, hey, we have this, we have that. And the people did not like it, Democrats. And something happened to Nate. He realized, I like the cash I'm earning. I like all the adulation I'm getting here. I'm a geek with a half-bald head here, and I'm combing over. I got to do something. The change began. The change began. He forecasted a 71.4% chance of Hillary Clinton defeating Donald Trump. Trump won with 304 electoral votes, according to 227. That was the beginning of the end. The midterm elections forecasts were accurate. No issues, but the midterms, the presidency that counts. 2020, again, I said again, but I apologize. I'm trying to look at my notes here quickly because I think I wrote too much garbage here. But they in 2022, they overestimated Republican chances. And then obviously in 2024, they completely missed the ball, you know. So let me cut to the point here. So the post-2008 record, in 2022, he overestimated Republican gains. He had misses in 2016 overestimating Clinton, and 2024 overestimated Harris. So he had notable errors in 2016 and 2024. And again, the 2016 election was a turning point. You know, in 2016, 538, 71.4% Clinton prediction, it was though higher for Trump than most models. It gave a perception of failure. You missed it. You should have got it. You should have been warning us. That way we could have fixed it. Now, why did this happen? Look, there's a consistent public misunderstanding of probability, and that fueled the backlash. A 29% chance for Trump, that was interpreted as a near guarantee for Clinton. No, it means there's a 28.6% chance that Trump's going to win. But the people are like, no, it's in the bag for Hillary. They don't understand. Hey, and we all do that. We see 90% chance. We're like, yeah, it's in the bag. And then when it doesn't happen, you're like, well, how happy are you with the 10% chance? And that shifted Nate's image, Silver's image, from a progressive hero to a target of blame. And in 2020, he got it right, but he missed a key state like Florida, which brought about skepticism about the reliability. Oh, we may have gotten lucky here. And then in 2024, they missed Trump's landslide. And so these few misses and how they were perceived is what began to kill them. And the fact they weren't making money. as a division.
So, they went from Silver's data-driven ways, where they were pretty accurate, some misses that started to turn to perception, and then when they started to change and do it differently, Nate was on board with that. Why? Because he was there from 2016 to 2023. And people are emotionally invested in election outcomes. So if you screw it up, there's no forgiveness. Like, Rasmussen is actually the most accurate, and they're always dismissive of that because it doesn't sit there and say that the Democrats are always going to win. So the 2016 and 2024 misses overshadow the earlier successes. Political polarization. Well, that amplified negativity. And conservatives mocked 538 as liberal propaganda, because that's a labor shifting. And liberals blamed them for not guaranteeing their victories. So they couldn't win or lose. And this is despite great forecasting in 2008, 2012, solid midterms in 2010, 14, and 18, and a correct 2020 call. See, I thought they were worse off than they did, but the problem here is it's those misses and them shifting to a different model after Silver left, and then not making money. And so they had a stigma on them now, and ABC News viewed them as an embarrassment because specifically the 2024 failure. And here's the kicker. In 2018, ESPN did explore selling them. They talked to the Atlantic and the Athletic, but they probably saw the numbers like, we can't afford this long term. Part of the downfall, too, was once they started excluding Rasmussen reports from their polling aggregation because they cited conservative bias. See, this is what blows my mind. Conservative bias with Rasmussen. Rasmussen is one of the most accurate because he doesn't have that bias. But they cited every biased leftist poll. Rasmussen accurately predicted Trump's 2024 win. The chief poster labeled it as regime information gatekeeper. 538 and Ginger Rasmussen. And again, they shifted from Silver's objective data-driven. But they did that while he was there, I think. After 2020. So the loss of 538 sports content in 2023, that kind of foreshadowed its full demise. And I saw that, I'm like, ooh, they're not doing sports. That means they're losing money. That means they could probably get that sports data or nobody's watching it or cares for it. And I knew that was the beginning of the end. So, Disney, cost cutting, they whacked one of their own leftist propaganda outlets. You know? And here's the thing, too. Disney could not sell 538, so they shut it down. So that tells you it was a money-losing operation. New York Times, ESPN, and ABC News, they explored selling it. Nobody wanted it. Makes you think. You only need a few people. I mean, you really do. That's it, with the way polling is done. The actual polling people, they need at the end. And Disney's losing money right now, so they needed to get rid of this. So, 538's demise, it does signal the end of a once thought to be revolutionary experiment. But instead, they debound a legacy tarnished by bias claims and high-profile misses. And Disney's looking to cut their losses. So the void it leaves in data journalism may spark new ventures. I know, I'll give you a little heads up. In my business plan, and we are a startup here, polling and doing something similar is there, but not at the level they have it in terms of manpower and all that. You can actually simplify this much, much easier, and they chose not to. But then again, didn't have to. Once you went corporate and you were wanted, you were seen as a golden goose, he caught his number, got his number, and eventually that number ended up being the demise of 538. And there you have it. Let us move on. Ubisoft's deal in the shadows, unpacking Tencent's ownership. So, Ubisoft is a leading French game developer, well known for Assassin's Creed Shadows, that whole Assassin's Creed series. They partner with the Chinese tech giant Tencent. The Chinese know what they're doing. This is a big, broader picture. They're playing the long game, taking control of major assets. And they've established a new subsidiary with Tencent, Ubisoft has. And it's focused on the biggest franchise, Assassin's Creed, as I said, but also Far Cry and Rainbow Six. It's ironic. Tom Clancy, Mr. Pro America, now his Rainbow Six is owned by the Chinese, the enemy. Can't make that up. So Tencent is investing 1.6 billion euros, which is about 1.25 billion US dollars. That's a lot of money. That's enough money to work. Looking at the bigger picture and their long game, they're going to eventually take over Ubisoft. There's no doubt in my mind. So the collaboration, though, technically aims to bolster Ubisoft's position in the global gaming market, accelerate development, and expand the reach of its flagship cities, i.e. Asia. So what are the ownership dynamics? Well, Ubisoft holds 75% majority stake in the new subsidiary. They're retaining creative and operational control over its intellectual properties. Tencent, for all, they have 25% minority stake. They are the money people. 1.3 billion. Then they're going to help with the Asia market. Supposedly, they're not going to dictate creative decisions, but they will. The woke is gone. China does not play that. Unless they're looking at this from a perspective of using it to continue the woke indoctrination that they do with TikTok, not Tencent, but China in general with TikTok, to pretty much poison our minds and keep our future growing generations dumb, lazy, and having a lack of innovation. Kind of like Europe is. I think for the last 3 years, we've gotten nothing innovated out of Europe, believe it or not. That's true. CEO Yves Guillemot, Mr. Guillemot, he frames this as a strategic move to strengthen Ubisoft's stability and growth. He's cutting or looking at the reality of it. It was to save his company. I don't know. Say out of their last 10, they've had like 70% failure rate with their big IPs or big money games. So what does this mean for you gamers? Well, Tencent's investment can shorten development cycles. Games come quicker, more frequent releases. It could improve the graphics, storytelling, and gameplay polish. Give or take on both of those. But what it will do is probably create a global expansion. Tencent's Asian market expertise will broaden the franchise's appeal with tailored content. But again, for today's gamer, that means nothing. That's a whole different market. I'm talking here the Western League. What are the potential risks? Well, Tencent is known for mobile gaming. That means expect more and more a game littered with microtransactions. Ubisoft retains control, but when they're giving that much money, Tencent will have input. And there's privacy concerns. Tencent's involvement sparks questions about player data handling. Look at TikTok. If you sign up for that, China gets all your private data. So what's Ubisoft's content or motivation for all this? They're struggling financially. They're, since 2021, I said it last week, their stock has taken about like 80-some-odd%. Then you have the delay releases, the astronomical cost of the games. So this partnership was a financial lifeline. And what does the subsidiary target? Targets their biggest games. Assassin's Creed, Far Cry, and Rainbow Six. So, and Ubisoft told staff, the details are still vague. They're not vague. They know what's happening. They just don't want to tell their staff because there's going to be dire consequences for that staff, i.e. layoffs, or a.k.a. layoffs. So there's cautious optimism among the people who benefit from this. But with the working class there, the grunts, the techs, the ones who build the games, the developers, there's a lot of uncertainty. What about Tencent? What did they get out of it? Well, Tencent's trying to backing Western gaming firms. It's expanding their global influence, and they're going to own a lot of this in 10, 15, 20 years. Obviously, they have capital. So, as a 25% stakeholder, plus 49.9% in Guillemot Brothers Limited, meaning Ubisoft itself, Tencent supports on paper right now rather than dominance, but they do have long-term leverage. So if Ubisoft's financial struggles persist, Tencent will likely increase its GBL stake to 51%, which means they would gain control of GBL's Ubisoft shares. or negotiate a higher subsidiary stake. Either way, it's a win-win. Over years, because I think in long game terms, this will shift Ubisoft's direction or ownership toward Tencent. Especially if the Guillemots or Ubisoft's board face pressure to sell. So this took months. This came out last week. People are acting like this took a week. No, it took much longer. Private likely talks were off and on for a couple of years. Hey, we're interested. Yeah, okay, we're interested. Then this last fall, let's talk. They saw, and once Star Wars Outlaws failed, they probably started initiating some talks. So what's this deal structure, the motives, and the fallout? So the subsidiary, it's an IP-holding entity. Ubisoft traded IP licenses for a 75% stake in the subsidiary. With 10 cents, 1.3 billion as cash. And it's valued at 4.3 billion now, which exceeds a very debt-burdened parent company, Ubisoft, that has a market worth of 1.9 billion US dollars. So the subsidiary alone is valued higher than all of Ubisoft combined. They took the best of Ubisoft, they put it in the subsidiary, they left the crap. This people who go, hey man, you're just trying to share the weaker IPs, there's some truth in that. The best franchises are in the subsidiary. So what's that mean? They could close shop. Maybe not today or tomorrow, but in the short-term future. So what could happen, though, to slow this down? Well, shareholders might sue if Ubisoft bosses screwed them over. That's breach their fiduciary duty. And how? They break the promise to act in the shareholders' best interest. However, we don't know how the deal is structured legally, and that could shield Ubisoft. It's too soon to know, because a lot of times this boils down to jury or judge, and sometimes they'll go, screw your legal crap. We see what you try to do. Guilty. Again, Tencent and China has a slow burn strategy. It's 49.9% in GBL, Guillemot Brothers Limited, and their 25% subsidiary could pave, and I believe will pave the way for takeover once the stakes grow and more pressure is put on those morons who throw movies up the ground after being one of the top, if not the top, gaming company in the world. No hostile movies imminent, because they have a 5-year lock on subsidiary shares. So what's that mean? In essence, Tencent's stock holding, or rather stuck holding their piece of the subsidiary for 5 years. They can't sell it, trade it, or dump it until 2030. That's when talks will happen. It's like agreeing not to sell a house you just bought for 5 years, keeping things steady for now. So what's this all mean? The Ubisoft Tencent subsidiary offers more games and quality potential, theoretically. It's tempered by risks like microtransactions, which will happen, and Tencent's growing influence, which will happen. In simple terms, us gamers, all we're going to get is more what they're putting out. Bad games, unless Tencent steps in and says, no, you need to do it this way. But right now, we're not going to get much as gamers. It doesn't really affect us, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And looking ahead, well, success depends on leveraging Tencent's resources while going back to Ubisoft's roots of building good games, not world-beating iCraft. Obviously, there's plenty of motives, legality, and long-term control, as we talked about down the road. All right, my friends, let's move on. The White House Correspondents Association dinner drama. Comedy club and journalism take center stage. So the White House Correspondents Association's dinner, it's always been a long blend of comedy and journalism. They ditched the comedian last week. They canceled her after her bigoted one-sided attacks at the Trump's admin. It sparked outrage and reignited debates over the event's purpose. President Eugene Daniels sidelined her for journalism. Is this a reset? Does this expose deep divides within the association? Conservatives cheered, liberals jeered, and the Trump team branded it a weak dodge. So what did the bigot say? Well, the bigot's name is Amber Ruffin. She made incendiary comments on the Daily Beast podcast. Quote, "There's no way I'm going to be freaking doing that." Meaning she's going to ignore the Correspondents Association's guidance that balances jokes across political sides. Quote 2, "They were like, you need to be equal and make sure that you give it to both sides. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be freaking doing that." Doubling down, I'm like, screw your guidelines, screw what I agreed to, I'm not going to do it. Quote 3, she described the Trump administration as, quote, "kind of a bunch of murderers," unquote. What a bigot. Quote 4, "making jokes about both sides makes them feel like human beings, but they shouldn't get to feel that way, because they're not." So she was saying we're not human beings. Then they remind this fool, this racist, this bigot, that Trump did more for her community than Obama did, than Biden did. Quote 5, "it's bonkers that we're still acting like things are normal." We're trying to get back to normal. You were going for an authoritarian leadership where our rights were being taken. They could dictate what we could and couldn't say. They could dictate the corporations what they could and couldn't do. This is all documented. But you're too stupid to know that. Amber Ruffin. So we deserve it. We back the move. It's a win against leftist hate, leftist bigotry, and leftist racism. And the association itself, White House Correspondents Association, says it's a deliberate shift to celebrate reporters. But what does her remarks do? There's a debate about humor's role at the event. We all love humor, as long as it's done both ways. I can laugh at anything Latino, male, whatever. As long as you're cracking on the women, too. And the blacks, whites, Asians, too. When you make one side, I want nothing to do with it. And that's what I had become. Anna Ruffin, I never heard of her. I guess she worked in late night television. She was, I guess, the first black woman to write for late night network talk show. I don't care. I guess that was late night with Seth Meyers. I kind of find that one hard to believe. Oh, okay, 2014. I don't know. I still find that hard to believe. Why? Because Garrett Morris wrote his own skits too on SNL back in 1975. So that would technically make him a writer. She hosted the Amber Ruffin Show on Peacock, lasted a couple of years. And odds are it never got viewership. They were committed to it. These networks, they can't do it. They don't draw viewership, but then they'll stick with it for a couple of years. Disney's finding out the hard way what happens. She served as a team captain on CNN's Have I Got News for You. Improv and theaters where she got her start. But she isn't a household name like, say, Ellen DeGeneres or Dave Chappelle or others like that. Her visibility is limited to comedy insiders and progressive circles. So in other words, nobody knows her. So the history of the White House Correspondents Association dinners as of the last few cycles has devolved into a hateful fest. They target Republicans, and they don't touch Democrats. And this started in 2018 with Michelle Wolf. She grossly and violently or maliciously attacked Sarah Huckabee. Said nothing about Trump or Michelle. Honestly, they say Michelle's beautiful. I'm like, you look like a damn linebacker, woman. That'd been a great joke. Pick on both of them, but they refused to. Even Stephen Colbert would give it both sides. So, social media conservative outlets like Town Hall, they've long claimed it favors leftists. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know this. They gave Hillary Clinton kid glove treatments, sidestepped her controversies. And Trump said, screw it, I'm not going to it when he first got elected. And that's what I think hurts him. They went from the spotlight to the shadows. They no longer had relevance. They were once a marquee event, commanding wall-to-wall coverage on C-SPAN and front-page headlines. Now it's a minor cultural footnote. The only people that cover it are leftists, and even then it's just a small little paragraph on one short story. Viewership peaked in the 1990s with Bill Clinton's roast. Even outlets like the Washington Post and Politico note its diminished clout. In 2018, they just put the tombstone on top of it because that's when it truly died. 2019 was no cut comedian. It's gone from must-see TV to only insider navel-gazing, meaning the only people that care about it are insiders who follow it. So her removal is actually a great move to start regaining relevance. Get rid of the trash. And that's step one to regaining relevance. Because it's a clear rejection of left-wing hate. We're like, hey, if you want to crack on one side and the other, we're with you. But not just the conservative side of the world. So Ruffin's exit marks a turning point for a dinner that's fading from cultural relevance and must-see to nothing but a polarized relic. They're betting on substance over satire to start their reclamation project. So when this pivot restores its luster, I don't think it will. I think it's going to cement its slide into irrelevance is the story we will watch over the next couple of years. And there you have it, my friend. In the final 10 minutes here, let's get you the rundown. Where I break down the top 10 stories, top 8 to 10 stories around the nation. The rundown number one, Elon Musk part one. Elon Musk ex-valuation reclaims $44 billion. So, he bought this company X Twitter at the time for $44 billion, and it surged back to that valuation. And that was last week. So I guess technically that erases doubts from the tumultuous post-acquisition phase after his $44 billion purchase was mocked. And it's because of innovative updates, expanded live streaming, a revamped algorithm, prioritizing free speech, premium subscription tiers. You have a revitalized user base. They exceed 600 million monthly active users. They defied and overcome advertiser pullouts, and their valuation dip. They overcame that as well. And it's funny. To give you an example, AOC was like, just got 1 million followers on Blue Sky. Yeah, where did she announce that? She came to X to announce it. Shows the power of X and where the true ruling class in terms of social media platforms are. So, you know, they're looking at this as becoming the next WeChat. It's a Chinese chat program that's like one of the biggest in the world. Skeptics say it's an inflated by market hype and loyalist investor sentiment. Maybe, maybe not. It doesn't lack clear revenue growth. It needs time. And Elon will give that. And that came from the New York Post. Part two. Elon Musk X acquired by XAI in a $33 billion deal. So I guess you took a $10 billion loss. But this was an all-stock transaction. And this came just last week. It's a significant consolidation of its tech mergers. So, again, X has over 600 million active users, real-time data streaming, with XAI's advanced AI capabilities that include Grok. And that fuels speculation that Musk is going to transform X into a more AI-driven platform, enhancing features like content moderation, user engagement, and data-driven services. And I get that impression as well. Now, people are talking about the valuation. He purchased it for $44 billion, faced revenue declines, and reduced valuation. However, XAI is worth $80 billion. So people are talking about this is self-dealing. It makes perfect sense on paper. If it was done legally, it's a smart move by Elon. I'm rooting for X. It is the only place where you can get dialogue from both sides. Facebook is dead in America. Instagram is not the right place. The conservative and leftist social media only platforms, that they have limited audience. So X is a place to be. That was rundowns number one and two, part one, part two. Rundown number three, Harry Sison scandal unveiled. I'm a little late to the game, but I wanted to talk about this. So, it has become very controversial. Allegations center on little old Harry, who, from my understanding when I was researching this, most people thought he was gay. You know, but Sison was soliciting explicit images from women under false pretenses, which obviously damages his credibility. Why are the male feminists the worst of the law? So there's evidence from leaked messages that suggest financial impropriety and intensifying scrutiny and then cause for accountability. What's going on, Harry? He finally responded via TikTok late last week, admitted to messaging multiple people, but claiming he was not in a relationship, and blamed Republicans and MAGA for exaggerating the situation. So here's the truth. My take, we didn't exaggerate, although conservatives did not exaggerate it. We held him to the same standard they try to hold our side to. And he doesn't like it. And that came from Sports Skeeta. Good luck, Harry. But now you'll be a running joke like Swalwell. His political career is over. He'll be able to remain a congressman, but that's it. Because he's gas man, fart man, and he slept with Feng Feng, a Chinese spy. All of this is alleged, including the tubing on camera. I did it too! That was my foot rubbing the floor! Rundown number four. Well, I'm sorry, my final point is that's the relevance Harry will now take. Because every time he says something, they're going to just go to that. Actually, every time after the guy who molested or said this or that, and do it in an asking question, you're okay. Rundown number four, Palestinian director's assault in Hollywood's Know Their Land package. So, okay, so Oscar-winning Palestinian director Mohammed Al-Khatib alleges he was beaten by Israeli soldiers following an attack by settlers. While Hollywood rallies behind Hamdan Balayel's documentary, No Other Land, that spotlighted Palestinian displacement, showing Palestinian bigoted perspectives, meaning they only getting the Palestinian people as we're the victims, and they had no responsibility for anything. Obviously, that earned praise from the anti-Semites in Hollywood. As this is the bold narrative, this is all my opinion. So his assault claim stems from a violent encounter in the West Bank. Now that's true. It's already violent over there. I mean, remember October 7th, the people that Al-Khatib supports killed more than 1,000 Israelis. So this incident has sparked outrage and demands for accountability. It's not going to go anywhere. But I'll say this. They were lukewarm in the response of the support, and 600 Hollywood actors and actresses wrote to support them. That's what you do. If you're going to be an anti-Semite, go full-blown anti-Semite. And support a man who supports terrorism. And that came from Breitbart and The Wrap. And The Wrap is leftist and Breitbart is not. The rundown number five, that actor I told you about, that big name actor I told you about earlier. Roberto De Niro's anti-Trump stance linked to box office woes. So, maybe a few days, this happened last week. You know, he hates Trump. And they're saying that's a factor, a big factor in the dismal box office performance of The Alto Knights. And my understanding is like it's not even going to make like 1% back or 3%, some ungodly number like that. So it's a gangster flick. He plays dual mobster roles, which critics said you didn't need to do. It tanked with $3.1 million domestic opening against a $45 million budget. So that means it has to make approximately $135 million to break even. At $3.1 million start, I don't see that happening. That's a far cry from the Meet the Parents when they came out 20, 30 years ago at $166 million. And his political rants is what has alienated everybody. He was originally a press-shy legend. Now you can't get him off the camera, bad-mouthing Trump. I mean, he's going to be like, Trump, that's what's going to happen to him one day. The way he's going, calm down, big man. Calm down, Bobby. Calm down. I mean, he has bleep Trump rants all the time. That's from HollywoodInToto.com. That's a great site, HollywoodInToto.com. Check it out. Rundown number 6, Bobby Kotick sues Kotaku and Gizmodo for defamation. This one's about a month old. It's missing in my queue. So, former Activision Blizzard CEO Bobby Kotick has filed a defamation lawsuit against Kotaku, Gizmodo, and their parent company, GO Media, over articles he claims smeared his reputation. Now, Kotick alleges that the outlets published false statements in March of last year about workplace misconduct at Activision Blizzard tied to unrelated rumors of him eyeing a TikTok purchase, despite knowing those claims were debunked by a 2023 settlement. So the lawsuit was filed in Delaware Superior Court, accuses them of maliciously including withdrawn harassment allegations to harm them. Meaning they knew it was old news, they knew it wasn't true, but they included it in the current news to make him look bad. Good luck, Bobby. I hope you destroy Kotaku. They are what you call a rag. Rundown number 7. The Russo brothers' Netflix disappointment. This came out a couple weeks ago. But they, I mean, what the hell are you doing, Netflix? $320 million movie? It was in the top 10 for about a week, and boom, it's gone. Not only is that a lackluster reception, it's a bomb. The movie has a convoluted plot, which I was told isn't even similar to the book. Uninspired execution, and it's failed its massive budget. And this does underscore the difficulty sustaining your interest in a crowded streaming landscape, which is why I don't understand. Look, I gotta be honest. This movie and others with big names, Ryan Reynolds, The Rock, etc., others, they've had a rapid decline once the movies are released on the streaming services. It's difficult to sustain your interest. Who hasn't? Adam Sandler. You don't have to spend an arm and a leg. Now, him is gonna cost him an arm and a leg because he's so successful. But these big projects, what's killing them is bad script writing. It's like, you didn't win it. Like, is that it? It's like, where's the twist? Where's it? It's just terrible. This came from GamesRadar.com. Rundown number 8, PC gamers embrace retro gaming. That's me, baby. That's me. So PC gamers are increasingly turning to older titles. Nostalgia, desire to escape the glitches and wokeness and monetization, the cost of newer games. Beyond Doom and Warcraft 3, Half-Life, Diablo 2, and The Elder Scrolls 3, Morrowind. They are like big fan favorites and still have a lot of traction. In fact, some of these games beat some of the newer releases in terms of Steam and how they track gameplay on PC. Why? Because you have refined mechanics, immersive worlds, I mean, so much to play. And that's a stark contrast to today's frequent launch day patches. And microtransactions again. So we're looking for timeless gameplay is what we're looking for. And we also like the fact that there's a lot of passionate modders out there that are updating these games. Half-Life is an example. And that came from Game Rant, where our good friend Hody Johns works at. Hey, here's one everybody will like, nostalgia. Rundown number 9, Pat Sajak's Game Show Return. Pat Sajak, iconic former host of Wheel of Fortune, is returning to host a special final spin run of Celebrity Wheel of Fortune. And that's going to air at the end of April. Fans are loving that. 41 seasons. We did this. So the comeback celebrates Sajak's story legacy, obviously. Over 8,000 episodes, 42 years on the flagship show. And I guess this gives him one last spotlight after taping these episodes before his exit. People are wondering, is this it? And we don't know. So these episodes were done a while ago, but because of Monday Night Football, they didn't want to post them or show them then, and they waited till April, huh? That's some odd network strategy. Not odd network strategy, but that's a big gap. Again, the fans are happy. He's an ongoing consultant with Wheel through 2027, and he has casually hinted on X about getting back on TV tonight. Good for you, Pat. I kind of mixed up a couple stories there, but just realized he's coming back in Wheel of Fortune, which I've never watched. I've seen snippets of it. I'll catch it on TV if somebody else is watching it, if I'm somewhere, you know, and that's about it. That came to us via FoxNews.com. final one. Round down number 10, wrestling. The World Wrestling, WWE, I'm trying to entertainment legend, challenges Tim Ross. WWE legend challenges Tim Ross. Boy, let me spit that out. Before I go on, check out Kane. WWE icon Glenn Jacobs, a.k.a. Kane, has challenged Minnesota Governor Tim Ross to a charity wrestling match. Now, he did that right after he was interviewed by my good buddy Big John on his podcast, The Big Questions with Big John. Check it out at grimleesmedia.com or YouTube, Rumble, Apple's, YouTube or Rumble's your best options. Yeah, under Grumley's media profile. So Jacobs, now Knox County Mayor, he aimed to raise funds while mocking Waltz as, in this corner, we got Tampon Tim. He's mocking him over a political jab. So it's a bit bold, but he's a wrestler. So he's blending entertainment with politics, stirring debate over common sense. But since it's charitable, we all know it's meant to raise funds and poke fun at everything. That came to us courtesy of outkick.com. And there you have it, my friends. There you have it. That's a wrap on the Rude Rundown. And the Red, White, and Rude. Flocks like Snow White and the 538 and 538 remind us that fame is fleeting. And deals like Ubisoft, well, that hints at some dark shadows ahead. That's a pun on AC Shadows. Or AC Assassin's Creed. The shadows. It doesn't work, William, when you gotta tell them what it means, does it? So, from comedy cuts to wrestling challenges, we've unpacked all the chaos this week. But before I leave, don't forget to like and share this podcast. Bookmark grumleesmedia.com and subscribe to us at your favorite platform. YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, Pandora, under the handle Grumbies Media. Do not forget, give us your thoughts in the comments on this week's show, agree or disagree, and stay tuned for what's next in this wild, wild ride we call America. This is William Del Pilar for the Red, White, and Rude. Until next week, and don't forget, politics is always downstream of culture, and I'm here to break it down for you.